Welcome to episode 31, The Hard Truth About B2B E-Commerce. I'm your co-host, Isaiah Bollinger, and I'm here with my amazing co-host, Tim.
Well, thank you for saying amazing. I'm Tim Peterson. It is a pleasure to be back. I hope everyone's doing well at the beginning of 2021. It's the start of the new roaring 20s. That's where I'm putting a stake in the ground. It's the start. So I do want to give a quick mention to our sponsor, PunchOut2Go. We thank them once again for sponsoring us well into our second season. They are a global B2B integration company specializing in connecting commerce business platforms with e-procurement and ERP applications. PunchOut2Go's iPaaS technology seamlessly links business applications to automate the flow of purchasing data. With their solution, you can immediately reduce integration complexities for your PunchOut catalogs, electronic purchase orders, invoices, and other B2B sales order automation documents. So thank you to PunchOut2Go. And back to you, Isaiah.
Yeah, this is, I think, another exciting episode. We've got a special guest today, CEO of Connexium, who actually, we actually had Justin Finnegan earlier on the podcast. I think he had just joined you guys. So he was still pretty new to the Connexium team. So I think this will be good to kind of get your take on things as well. So tell us about your background. Like, how did you, I mean, Connexium, I think, is, it's quite a mouthful saying what PunchOut2Go is. I think you guys might describe yourself somewhat similar, but it's obviously different. You know, can you tell us a little bit about Connexium and then also your background? Like, you know, I'm sure there's a path that got you to Connexium. You didn't just
Sure. Haven't
been working there your whole career.
So. Yeah, no, sure, Isaiah. And yeah, we actually know Brady and the PunchOut team well. And where we live in the same ecosystem, we definitely solve a different problem. So Connexium, our value proposition is extremely straightforward. We help our customers automate trade documents that their customers send to them. If you look at manufacturing and distribution in the United States alone, there's about $15 trillion of spend that happens every year. And believe it or not, about 48% of that is still manual. So we tell our investors in the market, we sit in about a $7.5 trillion market. And that trillion-dollar market is a customer creating a purchase order like they've done, going to their ERP system and automatically creating a PDF or a fax and coming in to our customers. And we automate that with 100% accuracy.
And then you have to, you know, once they create the purchase order, then you have to send an invoice against the purchase order to get paid, right? Or the vendor has to send the invoice over and then they have to process it. And it's funny you're saying this because we're going through this right now with a fairly one of our larger, you know, new customers. So they're new. So we're getting set up and like, you know, we tried to follow their instructions of how to submit invoices. I guess we did something wrong or they're actually, I think we found that there's a mistake in their instructions. And it's like, it's so, I see the emails going back and forth between our controller and them. It's like so much time going back and forth to just like process one invoice. It's just like mind boggling to me. Like literally, like they've already signed the contract. All they need, they only have to pay two invoices for this one deal. It's like so much time is going into this process. It's just,
yeah,
like,
it's a pretty manual process and there's complexities to it, right? I mean, you have business rules, you have financial terms, you have a lot of business logic that's specific to you, in your example, right? To you and that trading partner. And we've got a platform now that's, we've seen a lot of, as you can imagine, doing it for as long as we've been around for about 15 years, and we've seen over 50,000 unique documents. And with the algorithms we've built out and now with machine learning, we can really predict who that trading partner is, where that data should fall. And then we have patent-pending technology that actually extracts it and translate that and applies that business logic to it, to where now that's a touch. So that order is as digital as an order that will come from PunchOut2Go. It's as digital as an order that will come from my previous business, you know, which is now Salesforce B2B Commerce or EDI. So that's the modern customers we're working with now. They're looking at e-commerce broadly and they're saying, okay, I'm not going to force my customer to change, and I'm going to stand up an e-commerce platform. We're going to capture maybe new revenue there. We're going to continue to support EDI, but I'm going to automate this manual piece to where now I get digital orders across my entire business. And if you can do that, the ROI is it's pretty staggering for all of our customers.
Makes sense. And you're kind of going to that first topic that we wanted to get into in automation, because that's really a lot of what B2B e-commerce is about. So I'd love to hear your kind of like big picture view. You kind of said it, but let's get into that more. Like, so there's, you know, there's some of the manual processes that you guys can automate or can be automated. Then you have B2B e-commerce, which I think can automate a lot of the processing for especially smaller orders. Like we always say, like a lot of these B2B companies, they'll have like a huge chunk of their customer base pays, you know, the average order value is like less than $1,000. Like they might, you know, have $1 million orders, but they still have a ton of $1,000, $500, $2,000 orders that I think should be going through e-commerce, and obviously potentially larger orders. And then you have the EDI. So like, how would you, if you were, you know, the CEO of a B2B company, like what would you do? Like, how would you approach that from an automation perspective?
Yeah. I mean, so ideally, if I could force my customer to change their buying behavior, I'd force them to my e-commerce portal, because I could upsell them, I could cross-sell them, and it would push all the burden and all the cost onto my customer.
Yeah.
If I could do that, that's what I would do. Now, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah.
Right. Because we're not when we're looking at delighting customers and we're talking about customer experience and improved customer experience, forcing them to change something that isn't a burden to them is not something that we see our customers do. So what I would do is I would look at my customers, I would look at the industry, and I'd say, okay, maybe I need to stand up EDI to support this large customer. And I'd stand that up, right? I'd have a subset of customers who I would want to allow them, you know, broad depth and be able to punch out to my catalog via a procurement platform like Akupa, right? Or an Ariba. So I'd have maybe Brady's team come in and help me do that.
Yeah.
I'd probably stand up an e-commerce platform, because maybe it's one click reorder, maybe it's net new customer acquisition that could use that. But then I'd look at my other cohort of customers and I'd say, okay, can I incent them to self-serve? If I can't, what can I do to take the 20 people who spend all day processing these manual orders, what can I do to automate that so I can reallocate those 20 people to do more value-added tasks? So I wouldn't look at e-commerce only as add-to-cart checkout. Because again, in B2B, that's like 7% of the problem. I'd look at 100% of the problem and say, how can I digitize, automate, and optimize that entire spend?
Yeah. And then I think that there's that interesting point that you made that I think a lot of our customers struggle with, is like, what do I do with those 20 people, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, increasingly, we see a lot of our customers, if you look at the health, you know, Tim talked about the roaring 20s. You know, I talked to customers December, November, this month, the conversation is a lot different than it was March, April of last year. Right. So there's a lot more optimism in the marketplace today than there was just whatever that is, six, 8 months ago. So they're saying, listen, I know I'm going to grow. I'm seeing demand come back. Right. But I don't want to have to hire a bunch of people. So I want to reallocate these people from doing manual tasks to doing more value added tasks. So a lot of our conversations are around customer experience and allowing their people to do more value-added tasks, which will ultimately result in more revenue, greater customer sat, less customer churn, et cetera. Right now, we do have some customers that will still say, hey, listen, I need to right-size my business. I need to drive cost out of the business. And we're really good. We're a really good platform if companies want to do that. But increasingly, it's a customer experience and do more with the same amount of people value proposition.
Yeah.
That we're just, I mean, it's a fastball down the middle for us, right? Like if you've got 20 people spending 50% of their time doing manual order processing, the business case is pretty easy.
Yeah.
And you
can why would I not buy this?
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. And that's really, it's, you know, that's one of the things that got me so excited about this business is it's a value proposition you can explain to your mom, right? And technology, as we know, that's not always an easy thing to do.
That's right? Good. Because sometimes I try and explain the stuff that we do. We're an agency and we do some pretty like sophisticated development. It's just like, I'm like, how technical are you? Sometimes I ask people, like, do you understand anything I'm saying? So I try and level set.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you said it right. You said it right. Like, it's like, why would you not do this? And more often than not, another exciting thing about this business is every customer has this problem, whether they're Fortune 10 or they're a $30 million distributor.
Yeah.
Most of them don't know you can solve it with 100% accuracy. But when we educate them that it can be done and we can do it, the conversation flows pretty quickly from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing I want to jump on too, and, you know, I love saying this Roaring 20s thing because it's catchy and fun, right? It's the new Roaring 20s, Roaring 20s 2.0 or whatever it is. but you latched onto exactly, you know, where I was with this. You know, things have been very difficult for people for quite a long time, or they've been very confusing, or there have been, you know, extraordinary changes, you know, all of these things, right? So I think that the optimism is there because people are realizing that there are, you know, new opportunities, right? I mean, there are new ways to look at the world. And I think that that's also part of, you know, where I go in a lot of these conversations I have with the folks I work with. It's like, well, you know, everyone taught digital transformation for years, and maybe they did something and maybe they didn't, but they also had a similar view of what digital transformation was. COVID kind of threw that and shook it, right? You know, it's like, now that's not really the case. Digital transformation can mean a lot of different things to people in B2B e-commerce today. So what do you kind of think of that, kind of that angle, like what digital transformation really means given COVID and a lot of the changes that have happened in the past year?
Yeah, I think it's I think, you know, as everybody in our industry has seen, right, we've accelerated years and years in just a couple months, and it was based on necessity. You know, like as an example, I got here in February of 2020, and I did my research before I came. Never in a million years did I think that, hey, you know what, this application is going to be a business continuity application. Because what's going to happen is people are not going to be able to get into the office and do the work. So we're going to need to translate these documents digitally to enter them into the sort. Like, I never thought that would be a value proposition. I can tell you without a doubt, it was absolutely a value proposition in 2020 and now in 2021. And I think into the future, because people are going to want to have a more agile, more nimble, flexible business to be able to deal with whatever curveball is going to get thrown at them. And I think automation is a huge driver for a company to be able to do those types of things. And I think digital is another driver to be able to do those types of things, right? Like, I've seen the customers that have thrived are ones that embraced digital, embraced it broadly, embraced automation, looked at e-commerce more than just their own storefront, but, you know, relevancy in a marketplace, their own storefront, other channels. Those are the ones who, you know, those are the types of customers that we want to go work with, because they want to modernize their business. And so I think that that's sort of how I see it today, last year, and how I see it into the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, you're not alone. And I think that that's, you know, amazing, right? To just jump on these things where you realize that some of the things you were doing, maybe they were kind of like number two, three, or four on the list, or like the uses of them, or, you know, what people might do with them. And then all of a sudden the world flips upside down. You have these, you know, advantages actually in the marketplace now that you may not have had before. But if you're not like in the right mindset to think about innovation, right, and think about transformation, what that really means, you might not know what to do with them. And right. So that's another thing. It's like having that culture in your business to talk about this stuff.
We had a lot of customers come to us in the pandemic and be like, you know, we don't know how we would have done it. I mean, it just felt so great. They literally would say, we don't know how we would have done it without you guys, right? Because now their orders were, so maybe they were in PPE or safety, like their orders are flowing in faster than they ever could have assumed. And the fact that they had a platform like ours was just huge for them, right? Because if they had to stand up an e-commerce site like that, I mean, you guys know B2B, that's 6 months out. 9 months out, 18 months out before you even take your first order. So,
yeah.
You know, we turn these guys on in 30 days and off we go.
Yeah.
You do a really good job with B2B e-commerce. You can be up and running in 3 to 6 months, but that means you got to have like your product data organized and you know, yeah,
really good job. It ends up
taking longer because they don't have their
product. I spent a chunk of my career in the services industry. You need to do a really good job to get it done in 3 months.
You know, I love some of the hybridizations is kind of the way that I put it, to that, you know, the ways that people have thought about, you know, how to do their business differently or to do other things, like, you know, restaurants that became grocers briefly, you know, sold their supplies online to, you know, consumers or to other, you know, like to hospitals, you know, to make sure people were being fed and food was going there as opposed to their normal models, or liquor businesses, you know, selling hand sanitizer all of a sudden, right? It's like all of these astounding things that people were able to figure out pretty quickly. But, you know, as Isaiah just said, you know, you can't, there might be a window there, and sometimes to do this right, you can't do it instantly. You can't shift those gears, but having the mindset again, you know, in place and having the culture in place can really advance these things faster.
So I wanted this kind of, you know, I'm looking at our topics and they're all great topics. And I think this kind of covers all of them in a sense, like this, what I want to get at is this experience. I think you're seeing that, and I totally agree with you that actually the HubSpot CEO or the CTO keynote speech was like, experience is how you sell is the new product, is the new like value add. So like, you know, he's going through all these use cases, and basically like the companies that have really good automated sales processes are the companies that are winning, like, you know, Peloton and, you know, Chewy, like, you know, all these like online experience companies. There's this one that like you can like buy a car from like a vending machine. It's like this new startup thing that
So Carvana.
I don't know them very well, but talk about like
they're great.
The customer experience in B2B and why that needs to evolve. Cause I think it's definitely, in my opinion, way behind B2C in terms of evolution. And then kind of tied to that, if you can automate those 20 people, or not automate them, but like free up those 20 people's worth of time or whatever it is with a Connexium and a Punch Out to Go and all these things, how do you use them to make it? Because I think that's where people are getting stuck, is they're like, okay, I get Connexium. Okay, now what do I do with these people? Like, I think a lot of people running these organizations aren't customer experience savvy type people, and they're not, you know, modern digitally savvy, you know, innovators. So they're not really like, all the time, where they're trying to hire some random guy. He knows nothing about B2B commerce. He's like a marketing guy, but he's really not the right fit. You know what I mean? I think there's just this gap there in terms of what they should be doing.
Right. So a fair amount to kind of unpack there. So I say, you know, one, just take a step back and be like, okay, how does our customer want to engage with us? What does great look like for them? Do they want to self-serve? Great. Let's build a robust portal for them. Let's make it content rich. Let's make it easy to use. Let's make it mobile friendly, all the things we need to do, right? So they can come in and maybe they just want to look at order status, or maybe they want to understand new product launch. So let's give them that, right? Do they want to find us wherever they shop, right? Okay, so great. So now it's not, maybe we don't put our products on our website. Maybe we have a plan to really win on Amazon or HD Supply or Lowe's.
Yeah.
Right. Do they want to buy through a procurement network? Great. We've got solutions to do that. Do they want to buy the way which they've always bought? Right. Do they want to, you know, when I say when our stuff in B2B, it's convenient for a consumer to sit on their couch, click one, you know, click the button, one click buy, and the product shows up on their porch. That's great for the consumer.
And not go to the store, keep in mind.
Not go to the store. Right. Exactly. So
that's, not to call anyone.
Sure. That's convenient to the consumer. But in B2B, maybe it's convenient for the consumer to do what they've always done, which is go into their system of record and hit click, and the purchase order gets emailed to the customer. So I tell my customer, listen, like, just because the burden is on you, not on the customer. So if you can try and force them to change, but if they don't want to change, they may go somewhere else. Now,
there's more options than ever. Like, that's the thing too. I think in the past, you know, you have these relationships and people didn't want to, you know, I play golf with that guy. I want to fire my, you know, guy that I, it's like that, that world is changing. And I feel like that loyalty is not quite the same anymore. So if you make it, if you try and force them to change and they don't want to, it's
there's a lot of data on that too. Yeah. Just so I'm sure we all know that there's a lot of data. You can't force it. You can incentivize, right? Sure. But you can't force it.
Some can. I mean, some big guys can, right? Like some people in manufacturing, they can do it, but that's a, that's the rare exception who can do that. And that's where I'm so excited about our business, because we can give to our customer all the benefits of a digital order and delight their customer by not forcing them to change it. By the way, when they use it, the product is correct and it gets to the customer faster. Not only are they driving cost out of the system, but the product's going to get there. Like we have one of the largest distributors in the world. The second their order comes through Conexium, 15 minutes later, it's picked, packed, and shipped and out the door. Now they compete with Amazon. So that's kind of a
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But everyone's competing with Amazon.
Like, yeah, but these guys really compete with Amazon.
Yeah. Right? How could you not?
It's like that's table stakes, unfortunately, or realistically,
yeah,
you know, for them today. But yeah, I mean, I think just meeting your customer where they are and where they want to be and delivering a consistent experience across all channels, not just your digital channel. Right? I have customers who their digital answer is winning on Amazon. Great. Like let's do that. And that's delighting their customer.
So just to be super clear, you know, take those 20 people. If you think Amazon's the answer, which it could be for some people, one of our guests helps B2B companies with Amazon. So reach out to him. Put those 20 people on, uploading product data to Amazon, right? Is that kind of the answer?
Absolutely. If that's what the answer is, great. If it's, listen, I need to grow by 20%, so I need to add headcount this year in sales and service. No, you don't. Automate the manual stuff and let those people go play that role, right? Let them go sell to a customer. Let them go do really value-added, complex customer support to that customer.
So do you
allocate them anywhere in the business?
Yeah. Do you offer any type of strategic consulting based on, you know, best cases with different types of clients you have? So, for example, let's say there is that Amazon only or you know, whatever, these folks that are extremes in a way. Do you offer any type of consulting saying, you know, here are some other things you might do? Or is that not really in your wheelhouse?
Yeah, so we're a software. So I struggle with that answer. So we're a software as a service business. So we're, yep, you know, our business is to help our customers really address that inefficiency in that $7 trillion TAM. But you know, I can't let the when myself and you guys talked about Justin, like, you know, sometimes the ex-consultant, the ex-consultant always comes out. So I'd say at a value added, just partnership level with our, yep, customers. Absolutely. And when I talk to them, I want to understand. I ask them these questions, like, how do you define e-commerce? What's important to you?
Yeah.
And if it's, well, we've got to go win an Amazon and we don't know what to do, I'm going to say, hey, you know, here's some tactics. Here are some ideas. I'm more than willing to help. You know, if it's, gee, we need to figure out an e-commerce platform. And if it's me and Justin, as an example on the phone, I'm like, well, you got two guys here who spent a lot of time in that space. And, you know, we're more than willing to help. So I'd say we do it as a value add, but not as a core component of our business.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's funny. I just want to touch on this. Tim actually helped us. We struggled with kind of our branding and our messaging at Trellis because we do so many things. You know, we're consultancy and we do e-commerce is so broad, right? It's like you do e-commerce. We also do software development. We do design. So we finally settled on make commerce simple. We got rid of the E because it's just commerce.
Like, just commerce.
I think eventually, you know, I would love for Trellis to help, you know, install Amazon Go in our customer, because Amazon Go, you can actually license it, or they're working on that. So I believe eventually, you know, go into the store, walk out, it all goes to your e-commerce, you know, single portal that's for that customer, and it's all kind of unified. And if they buy online, they still can track, you know, they bought in the store twice and they bought online twice. So we have four orders, you know, for that.
I think it makes sense to me. I think that the letter E, you know, you can just see that getting. I mean, this is just how people buy now. People can buy in a bunch of different ways to, you know, delineate and, you know, say we only do this or we only do that. I just don't think that's not how your customer thinks about it, right? So if you're only thinking about that, you're not going to be able to give them the full level of support that they're probably looking for.
Yeah, because you might buy something, but then you want to return it at a local store because it's easier to just drop it off. I mean, it's so interconnected. So actually, I kind of want to diverge a little bit because I think this is very relevant to this audience. Is they struggle with this stuff. I mean, I think there's some simple answers like, you know, talk to Connexium.
go talk to them.
There are some SaaS solutions that you can go talk to. But I think when it comes to the services, that's where it is really complicated. Like, you know, now you need a service provider to do some of these things. You might also need to buy a couple different software, implement them. Can you talk about that background and how that relates to B2B commerce and how, you know, I think they all are going to end up having to buy some service providers in one way or another. And it's...
So I want to make sure I understand the question, Isaiah. Is the question... Do I foresee software as a service companies buying service providers?
Or to be more clear, it's if you're a B2B distributor, manufacturer, like any kind of B2B business selling product, you know, how would you go about finding the right service providers? You know, maybe you need an ERP service provider, maybe you need a product. I mean, I think product data is actually underestimated. You might want to get a product data service provider to help you kind of organize your product data. And then you probably also need like an e-commerce agency like Trellis to build your site, you know, even if you have one engineer, which most of these companies don't even have one real software engineer, they probably still need help. I mean, we have a lot of customers that have one engineer and then we're like kind of extra help for that person, you know? So how would you, where would you start? Like, I'm trying to kind of like help our audience think about, okay, let's go find some vendors because you can buy Connexium, you can buy PunchOut2Go, but I don't think that's, there's still like kind of a service layer to all of this, I think.
Well, so I'm going to answer that. I'm going to answer that selfishly, and then I'm going to answer that strategically and objectively. So selfishly, another reason that I was excited about this business and why I left Salesforce to come here is we don't have a dependency on an SI.
Yep.
Our stuff is very straightforward. We turn it on in 30 days.
Sure.
So that to me, as a software provider, was compelling, right?
Yeah. And that's pretty rare, though, like in general.
It's very rare. It's extremely rare. And we do that for the biggest of the big and the smallest of the small. So that's our technology. I believe we're uniquely positioned and to be able to do that for customers.
So now, let's say that's the 48%. You're solving that 48% of that market, right?
Right.
The other 52%, I don't really think there's a self-serve SaaS.
I agree with you. I agree with you. So take that aside. Mm-hmm. I had to put that commercial in there, though. So take the commercial aside.
You as a sponsor, right? Let's
communicate. It depends on the type of company you are. So if you're a billion or $500 million U.S. only manufacturer, you know, I think my advice to that person would be go find a specialist in that area who really understands manufacturing and understands the technology needed for that size of manufacturer to compete and win in this world. Right. And that, and there's a bunch of folks that fit that profile. Like this one just comes to mind because I'm friendly with them, like the Shift 7 guys. I don't know if you know that group or not. They're a very specific niche manufacturing distribution. That's what they do. And I just think that's I've seen that be.
Sorry, they're a service provider for manufacturers. What do they do exactly? Are they a service provider?
They're a service provider, right? So they may compete with you on the commerce side, but they do a lot of PIM work. They do strategy work. They do business case work. And
okay.
So I just like personally, I just think that's the right business model. Now, if you're Exxon, and at a C-level, you're going through a digital transformation.
Yeah.
And you need to have relevant expertise around how e-commerce works in Asia and how it works in the UK. And now that's a different profile of systems integrator, right? So there you'd want to bring in Accenture, Deloitte. So folks who have just that broad, just a lot of people who can do something, but they also have boots on the ground and regional understanding of how things work within a particular region. That's really important. right? Yeah. So I would personally think someone like a Deloitte or an Accenture would be overkill for that, you know, one division, big business, but one division, one country only.
I agree.
Right. But I would also say if someone like a GM really loved, you know, because of the relationship, say in Detroit, really loved the smaller agency, and then you want them to do the global work for you, you're going to really challenge that agency's ability to be relevant, you know, at the local level.
Yeah. But I think sometimes if you find the right agencies and we're at that stage where, you know, we could handle, you know, a solid mid-market global rollout, as long as it wasn't too crazy, right? Like, you know, we could probably handle, you know, a $500,000 projects, but I'm not sure we would want to eat, like we would want it. But like, if you said, hey, you need to do a $5 million project, that would be like too much hiring for us to do.
And I'm not even, my point wasn't even so much about volume of bodies to do the work, right? It's understanding how commerce might be different in Mexico.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Than it is in the UK.
Having boots on the ground in those areas. I totally understand what you're saying. Can we just go one step smaller? Because most people aren't Exxon. Most business owners are not Exxon. And even aren't a $1 billion, $500 million company. Let's go to like the $50 to $100 million. So I think that kind of like you can go up and down from there, and it covers most of the B2B companies.
Yeah.
So, you know, they usually can, I mean, I think it's a terrible idea for a $50 million distributor to hire Deloitte or Accenture, because they're going to be like, yeah, sure, we'll do that for $2 million. And it's like, they can't afford that, you know? So, you know, I think those are the guys that are really struggling because they don't have that, you know, the ones that I see are doing really well, they have a really good e-commerce manager, but most of them don't. They don't have that guy internally that can orchestrate, you know, hiring Trellis plus the PIN provider plus, you know, connect plus punch out to go and bring all these pieces together and work with the internal organization correctly. We have like maybe a small percentage of our customers in the lower market that have that guy. Most of them just don't have them.
Most of them don't have. No, I see. I've seen that for sure. So I'd say one, the CEO and the board, so let's pick 50, $100 million business, right? Mm-hmm. CEO and the board has to be bought in that they need to invest in digital. So first and foremost, so before I even answer the agent, so if they're not bought in, the answer is no agency is going to be able to make that company successful, period.
Yeah.
It's a waste of money.
Just give up.
you're going to lose.
Yeah.
Because the CEO and the board isn't bought in on what it takes to make a digital investment, it's just not going to work. Right. So first and foremost, it has to come from that. I think it has to come from that level at every business, but sure as heck at that $50 million.
I agree.
$1 million business. And then once you have that, I think you can then, if they're engaged, you can then through your network and whatnot, like you can find the right firm and I think incent the right firm to deliver an outcome. And that's what I would do. So if I ran a $50 or $100 million business, and I had no digital expertise and no commerce expertise, I'd go find a partner and I'd say, listen, like, here's my business plan. Here's what I think I can do in e-commerce. Here's what I think I do in Amazon, on my own site, whatever. This is what we think we can do. If I gave this to you, what do you think you could do? And inevitably, you know, the partner would probably look at that and go, geez, I think we could do this much more. I think if we put these resources, we could do this. And I'd say, great. Put your money where your mouth is. I'll pay you a baseline of X. Anything above X, I'm going to give you part of that. Anything below X, we're taking our build out. And now everybody's aligned. So now if I'm the CEO, the burden of hiring, recruiting, and retaining those digital experts is on you, the provider, to start with. Once I start to gain traction, now I've religious, now I believe it, now I see it, now I'm going to go hire that person to take it to the next level. That's how, because I just don't think, you know, this may sound rude, if I run a $50 million industrial distributor, the talent I'm going to get is not the talent that your agency is going to be able to get in that area, right? So what? Let's just,
you don't have to convince me.
This thing I'm together.
I think it's the hard truth about B2B e-commerce is it's 100% true. I mean, I'll give you just some personal examples. We legally, we cannot hire our clients' people, right? Because they, sure, you know, we do that on both sides. Like, we're not going to poach them and they're not going to poach us from our, yep, contracts. But we get asked all the time, our B2B clients, people on the ground asking for jobs at Trellis because they know, you know, we're so much further ahead.
That's right.
You know, strategically, and usually we don't consider them for two reasons. One, legally we can't. And honestly, they're not even qualified. They're like three steps below where we would want someone. So that's the talent that they're getting, where we're getting talent probably three, four levels above that. And I don't think these B2B companies quite understand that. I don't even know how to describe this. That's it.
Well, you know,
if you don't know how hard talent acquisition is and retention is and how competitive the space is, and you're just like, hey, we'll build a website and sell. You may be like, oh, hey, you built the website. You know how to do it. You do it. And then all of a sudden the person comes in, they're like, what's my paid search budget? And the CEO's like, what is paid search? You're like, oh no, we've made a bad decision.
So, yeah.
Well, what happens? Cause it's really funny that you brought this up, right? Because there's sort of a cycle I call, like, it's basically a 3-year cycle for a lot of the businesses that I've been involved in. I consult a lot. You know, I've been internally as an e-commerce guy. I've been an agency guy. I've done a lot of different things, but often what happens now is that, like, even a VC will hire me, have me go in to a business that they're investing in, or maybe some other people are investing in, right? And I'll have to go to the board and I'll have to say, hey, where are you in your digital transformation process? Here are the gold standards. Like, you know, and I do this, you know, presentation on behalf of people who actually want to make money and want to get them up to the level of the competitors, at least, or go beyond, you know, as an innovator. And it really is the cycle where it's like, oh, okay, I guess we do need to do this. How do we catch up? How long will it take? How many people, whatever. And it is a cycle that takes some businesses just way too long. And then some people never catch up, right? It's just a crazy cycle to be in.
Yep. Yep.
So sure. I want to, you know, we're kind of coming to the last half of this, or tail end of this. And I truly believe this, and I'm not trying to say this as a scare tactic, but as a warning, and I don't want to see this happen, but I think it's going to happen. And I'm calling it the B2B apocalypse. So, you know, we had the retail apocalypse, or mm-hmm. you've heard the term retail apocalypse, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think that kind of happened from 2010 to 2020, things after, you know, the crisis in 2008, you know, people started to shift more digital. Groupon came out, people wanted deals, and things shifted way more digital. And the retailers that didn't do that mostly died off. Toys R Us, Sears, lots of small ones you probably never heard of and we've never heard of, but a lot of big names. And I think that now we've kind of shifted to this new digital first retail environment. And I think most companies in retail have adapted to that in one format or another. And even like, I think Toys R Us is like revamping as just an e-commerce site. so I think that shift's kind of already happened. Like, let's say the retail apocalypse kind of already happened, right? And now we're kind of in the aftermath. I think this decade, we're going to see the B2B apocalypse. So 2020, 2030, businesses, or, you know, business buyers want that, you know, warp speed. I think that was one of the points that you guys made for buying. And I think the companies that don't take that view that you had, that kind of like bird's eye view of how everyone wants to buy and then figure out the piece for all of them, are going to die off. So I'm just curious what your opinion is of that. And, you know, what do you think will happen to the companies that embrace that versus the ones that don't? And am I right or wrong? Or am I being like,
I think we've already seen it, right? I mean, I think we've seen manufacturers who don't understand the customer and don't understand the customer need, and then maybe don't understand how to best engage with the customer. Those manufacturers are being bought, or they're going out of business, or their divisions are being spun off or shuttered. Right. So we're seeing that. I mean, we're surely seeing it on the distribution side. And I think you'll continue to see it on the distribution side. Right. If your only value proposition is the ability to pick, pack and ship. I know a couple of companies that are really good at pick, packing and shipping. Right. Yep. Like Alibaba, pretty good at it. Amazon, pretty good at it. Walmart, pretty good at it.
A lot of people, you know. Yeah.
Right? So they, even if they're not in your product category today, don't assume that they're not going to be in your product category tomorrow. And we've seen, you know, we've seen distributors go out of business. So yeah, I think, I think it'll be now, I don't think it will be as profound as it was in retail. Because again, I still think it's a B2B is more complex. I think there's multiple ways in which customers and distributors work with each other and how their customers engage with them. So I don't think it'll be as just profound as like, okay, the malls are just not places people are going to go anymore. Big boxes is not the way to buy anymore, whatever, right? Like, but I still think we're already seeing it. And I don't, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. I don't see any scenario where people become more brick and mortar focused.
Well, I think what I'm kind of getting at with this B2B problem, I think it's going to accelerate this decade, because I think you could kind of get away with it in the past decade. And to some degree, you know, I agree that it's starting to already happen, but I think it's really going to accelerate because now, you know, BigCommerce, Magento, the platforms of the world, Shopify, even they're building out more feature sets. So it's going to be easier to build a site. And then, you know, you have the Connexiums and the Coupas that are now Coupas like worth like what, 100 billion or something like that. They're like,
yeah, massive. It's up there.
And then, so I think that the technology in B2B is maturing very fast and very quickly. And because of that, it's much faster and easier to implement, you know, all this stuff in a year or two. And, you know, some companies can leap forward in 2 years, and the guys that don't, it's like all of a sudden that gap is just going to get bigger and bigger. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, if you look at, I mean, I've been doing this for a while. So if I look at the B2B e-commerce implementations, because I was on the services side. So when I, you know, think about the B2B e-commerce implementation I did at Grainger in 2007 and how long that took, how many people we had to put towards it and the tools we used. Mm-hmm. If I looked at that implementation today, I mean, it's not even right. Not even close. A time to market, number of people needed, technologies I would have used, additional technologies I could have deployed to make it even better. So yeah, that's only, I mean, just look at B2C, right? Like, you know, Shopify has absolutely changed the game, right? Mm-hmm. Look at the services they can bring to bear. Look at how long it takes to get to market. That dynamic is happening. And I think, I do agree with you there. That's going to continue to happen in B2B.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the little things I would add too is that, you know, what I've always said about B2C is that, you know, it's been a process of simplification and removing intermediaries, you know, removing, you know, people who are in the middle of any, you know, connection between customer product or customer service. And, you know, in B2B, there's still layers and processes and, you know, all these involvements of things that often complicate you know, what has to happen. So I feel like those will continue to fall away so that there's a very much, you know, more of a direct relationship between whatever you want to do and whatever you need. You know, that's the natural evolution of things. It's kind of like the conversation that folks have had about, you know, even just the term agency. And I know that, you know, what an agency is, I certainly am very familiar with many of them. But, you know, think about a real estate agent and, you know, and what an insurance agent does and what a dealer does at a car, you know, for a car company. Those are very interesting, weird kind of roles in a way. And so just going directly and getting what you need and want, right? So in B2B, all of these things, you know, need to kind of be evaluated, figured out, fall away.
That's right.
Transparency is coming. I think that's one of the key things that we've bet our agency, Trellis is a digital agency on, is trying to be more transparent than our competition. So we have people, they can log into Jira, they can see every ticket that we're working on. That's where we log all of our hours. They have access to Slack. Mm-hmm. Like we've tried to become is as transparent as possible. Obviously, they're, you know, we don't want to show them every little thing that we do. So I think that that layer of security in B2B is going to start to go away. Kind of to your point, like there's all these layers and they're going to slowly get peeled away.
I agree. It will. I mean, it's just, again, it's like B2B is kind of, they've kind of followed the trends of B2C, right? So I think you'll see it, right? Just like we're, you know, I think brands historically maybe were afraid to go direct to consumer. And I think now they just broke that down. And now you're seeing even in B2B, they're going to their distribution partners like, hey, my customer's demanding that I have a one-to-one relationship with them.
Exactly. You know, and I have a quirky question for you, Ray. I was thinking about this. So, you know, here I've had a big career in e-commerce and a variety of other things. But, you know, when I was in high school and college, there wasn't e-commerce, right? So, you know, what did you think you would be doing when you were like a high school guy? Like, I always wonder about that with a lot of folks who are like tech leaders and innovators in a variety of ways.
He was probably using automated B2B orders. You know,
That wasn't it. So I probably can't, you probably won't be able to publish the podcast if I tell you what I really cared about when I was in high school.
we don't have to go there, but
I'm not going to go there. But here's what I will say. I was lucky, and I'll use the word lucky enough to get into technology early. Mm-hmm. So my first job out of school was customer support at a software company.
Okay, cool.
So I was able to see, I was able to surround myself with career technologists, right? These are people who grew up in IBM and Microsoft, right? So I was just lucky to surround myself with those types of people. And I was also lucky enough to just get exposed to how disruptive technology could be. And I just got addicted to it. And then, you know, then I went, I left that company and I went to a services firm here in Chicago. And again, I think I got lucky to a degree where I found, I was just talking to a customer who they would send CD-ROM to consumers. They would install the CD-ROM into their computer, and the customer could then go online and buy groceries, and those groceries would get shipped to their home. This was in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And
that's pretty great.
And it was really interesting. And so we started with them and we helped them refine their ERP implementation. Hmm. But I got to know the co-owners of these businesses, and I got to understand how hard it was to just, you know, keep the cold stuff cold and the hot stuff hot, and just the complexities around it. And then, you know, they came to us and they said, all right, we want to build this thing on the internet. Like, we don't want to send CD-ROMs out anymore. That company's called Peapod. And so 98, I was lucky. I was just lucky, right? Like, I got to meet the Parkinson brothers, and these are the guys. And once I saw that was it. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, that was, I never looked back at that.
Honestly, point. I think Sovngarden should just go all in on Peapod. Like, you know, they've got a pretty good thing going, you know, just go all in.
that was it. And then I ended up, I did that. And then we ended up building an online marketplace, which competed at that point, it competed with eBay. It was called UBID. And that kind of went away. But anyway, so it was like, I got that taste, and that's it. Didn't have a gray beard back then, had more hair back then, but was doing it. That's when I was hooked.
You know, but I think one of the reasons I like bringing up things like that is that, you know, let's say we have a younger listener who's like in college or something. I mean, I mentor people in colleges and in business school programs. And what's interesting is, you know, some folks really have the idea that I'm doing this and this is what I will be doing 20 years from now. And I'm like, no, you're not, you know, like, not necessarily. It's like in 2041, do any of us really know exactly, you know, how things are going to be working in business? Not really. We, you know, it's kind of that openness and, you know, being part of teams that are innovating and technologists, you know, other people who are working towards something, right?
Surround yourself with really smart people. Mm-hmm. Go work at, like, if you got to take 10,000 less to go work at a place where you're just going to learn that much more as a young kid, bro. I mean, that's my, I'd give that advice every day and, you know, twice on Sunday. And like you said, you don't know who you're going to be. I have a senior in high school and, you know, he's figuring out what his major is going to be. And so I, you know, I just helping him think through it and doing some research. And I realized, well, in doing research, 70% of college students change their major twice.
Yeah.
Wow. So you don't know. You may think you know. You don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. I was an economics and psychology major. So
I was religious history. I majored in religious history.
So. Yeah, it's political science. Political science does not equate to SaaS CEO, right?
Not really. But there you go. Right. I mean, so I just like putting stuff like that out there to our listeners.
It was actually kind of interesting having me talk through it. Right. I don't get asked that question every day.
I'm glad.
I want to add one thing to that, but I totally agree. I think that's a mistake that people make just in business in general. Everyone's chasing the highest salary. And if you just take one step back and say, all right, you know, I'm going to go work for this B2B. I want to learn B2B commerce. I'm going to go work for that expert and take 10,000 less, or, you know, I'm going to downgrade my apartment from 3 bedrooms to 2 bedrooms and do that. Like, you know, in 5 years, you're going to make 10 times back, you know, 5-10 years.
Yeah.
Or just, it's not just high school students, it's everyone, you know what I mean?
For sure. No, we're lucky. I mean, I talk to our new hires every week, and we doubled the size of our business last year. And I talked to the, you know, we have a BDR team, you know, the outside selling team. And those are like some of the most fun people to talk to, because these guys are coming from, and these women are coming from all these different industries. And I tell them, I'm like, hey, you know, welcome to technology. You made the right decision and you're never going to leave. Yeah. Like, whether you stay with us forever, I don't know, but you made the right choice to jump into tech. And now you're, you know, if you own your career and you do well,
and it's okay if you make a little bit less that first year, you know, you don't make it back.
No, and a lot of these people have. I mean, I tip my hat to them, right? These are some of these people who are like, I need to get in, and this is how I'm going to get in.
That's pretty cool. That's great. So I have only one more quick question for you. It's kind of a flip side. So that's kind of past and thinking about where you are today. But, you know, what about Connexium going forward? Like, what do you think? Just like ideas 5 to 10 years from now, what do you think Connexium is going to be up to? 10 years.
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think in 5 to 10 years, you know, this business will be, it will be global in nature. Like, we made a big investment in Europe this year. We're going to continue to scale that. I think you'll see us go to other markets. Like, there are other markets that need our stuff. I don't want to overextend the team, but I think you'll see us there. I think you'll see us expand in other vertical markets. So very strong in manufacturing and distribution today. I think you'll see us do a better job in high tech. You'll see us do a better job in health and life sciences, right? Potentially financial services. And I think you'll see a huge advancement in machine learning, mm-hmm. and artificial intelligence, which will allow us to get our customers to value, like, almost instantaneously. Right?
Well, here's a use case. We're a digital agency. We still, you know, we send out manual invoices. We have actually built some automation around billing, but, you know, we can't automate everything right now. So, hey, you know, why eventually probably sell to us, right? Like, we have
there
to
go.
You
know.
There you go. That's it. We're inviting you back, by the way, on our episode in 2031. So we're going to book you right now. We're going to do that.
All right.
We have a lot more listeners.
I don't know. I'll take it from the boat.
Okay.
I hope I own your guys' stock by then. Like, you know, I actually own Coupa because Brady, you know, got me on the Coupa. Like, I didn't really even know what Coupa was. And then I started seeing it in some of the procurement when we started getting clients. And they're like, you need to, like, get the purchase order through Coupa. And I was like, wait, everyone's using Coupa. I should probably buy this.
Yeah, good idea.
So I see you guys kind of being one of those in a few years.
That's the plan. That's the plan, Isaiah.
Awesome.
It's the way to go.
Great. This was honestly one of the best, you know, most enjoyable episodes I've had for myself.
Oh, great. Yeah. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it. And, you know, stay safe, be good. We're almost hopefully on the other side of this thing. Have a good weekend.
So, well, 100 thank
million.
You.
When they say 100 million vaccines in 100 days.
Hurry up.
Let's do it.
Let's go. Get out of our basement and go have some fun.
Exactly. Thank you so much.
We'll all see each other in person, hopefully.
I would love that.
Thank you. Have a good weekend. Nice meeting you.
Thanks. Take care. Thanks, everyone.